Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday. Presidential primary elections in more than a dozen states, including the two largest, California and Texas. So we're going to look at presidential politics today. We're focusing on two main topics. In the second half of the show, we'll speak with a Cuba expert about Bernie Sanders complimenting the education system under Fidel Castro. So I hope you can stay tuned for that. And first up, we're going to take a deep dive into a possible brokered convention for the Democrats. We'll find out what that is and what that might mean. Could someone besides the delegate leader emerge from this summer's convention as the party's nominee because of superdelegates? We'll also take your calls. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can also email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. We're also broadcasting right now on Facebook Live, the WMNF News Facebook page. So thanks to Blaney Whalen for broadcasting us on Facebook Live right now. Well, I want to introduce our first guest, and that's Jessica Vaughn. She's the founder of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay. She's a supporter of Bernie Sanders, and we're going to talk to her about superdelegates to start the show. So welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
So glad that you could join us. So first, let's just start with what's the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay.
So the Progressive Caucus, caucuses are generally groups that help get people who either have issues specifically they feel passionate about or specific identities into the party and involved in the party. So there's identity caucuses like the Hispanic Caucus, the Black Caucus, Disability. And now these days, more issue-based caucuses are springing up where it's environmental caucus or things that are more issue-based. The Progressive Caucus takes many of the progressive issues all together, and we try to bring new members into the party who collate around those issues, as well as advocate for those issues to be a priority with our candidates and our platform, and to make sure that the foundations of the Democratic Party are really being upheld.
What are some issues?
So the issues would be Medicare for all. It would be racial justice, criminal justice reform. It would be public education and access to education in general. It would be most of the issues that Bernie Sanders fights for: a livable minimum wage, fight for 15 to something at the core of what we're fighting for, and also really to make sure that our democracy is reflective, right? To make sure that we're hearing the voices of the voters over the elite members of the party or the system in general, and being as engaging and reflective as we can.
And we'll talk more in this half hour, of course, about the elite members of the party, but we'll stay on this line of questions for a second. And has your local group endorsed a candidate for president?
We actually have. Generally, we are chartered under the state caucus. So for state and federal elections, the state caucus does the endorsements, but the Progressive Caucus of Florida has endorsed Bernie Sanders. They did a poll of all of their members, and he won over 67%. So luckily we have endorsed, and we're able to advocate for one candidate at this point.
And that's the statewide, but did your local do a separate endorsement?
We didn't, but we would have probably followed suit, I'm sure, so.
All right, well, in all this talk about delegates, and we know that you get pledged delegates mm-hmm. by winning parts of states in New Hampshire or Nevada and so forth,
right.
Or South Carolina, and the other state I'm leaving out right now is Iowa, of course,
yes.
the very first one. So right now, Bernie Sanders has a lead in delegates, mm-hmm. even though Joe Biden has actually gotten more votes in those first four states so far.
Right. Well, the last state really pushed him over the edge.
Yeah, there were a lot more voters in mm-hmm. South Carolina. And that part of that might be a tiny artifact of the fact that two of those states are caucus states, and
sure.
far fewer people
absolutely.
Caucus than go vote in primaries and
yes.
vote primaries. Maybe this would be a good time to ask you, do you see into the future, is something like caucuses, is that something that might be going toward the wayside in the future?
I hope so. I really feel like they're a form of voter suppression. Even myself, who's, you know, obviously very active, it would be a challenge for me on a weeknight to find childcare and be able to sit somewhere for 3 hours to vote for my preference. I know my sister lives in Washington State, and they had caucus previously, and for 2020, they switched over to a primary, and this will be the first time they use a primary system. So I think it's the most engaging way to make sure that we have as much representation as to make voting as easy as possible. And that's another platform of the Progressive Caucus, is to make sure that we're making voting more accessible to everyone.
Well, we want to talk this half hour about superdelegates,
yes,
and about a brokered convention. And mm-hmm. let's start with this quote that came from a debate right before the Nevada debate last month. Before the Nevada debate, that is, before the Nevada caucuses, six of the leading candidates at the time were asked if the delegate leader going into the convention should get the nomination. And, you know, if you're hearing this for the first time, which most WMNF listeners are not hearing this for the first time, but if you are, you're like, well, yeah, the delegate leader should get the nomination. But it's more complicated than that, and we're going to get into that this half hour. So here's what the six candidates were, how they responded if the delegate leader going into the convention should get the nomination. All of them, except Bernie Sanders, who answers last, said no.
We are less than 2 weeks away from a national primary, and I want to ask all of you this simple question. There's a very good chance none of you are going to have enough delegates to the Democratic National Convention to clinch this nomination, okay? If that happens, I want all of your opinions on this. Should the person with the most delegates at the end of this primary season be the nominee, even if they are short of a majority? Senator Sanders, I'm going to let you go last here because I know your view on this. So instead, I will start with you, Mayor Bloomberg.
Whatever the rules of the Democratic Party are, they should be followed. And if they have a process, which I believe they do,
I'm trying to do
so
this
that everybody else,
fast.
Everybody can.
So you want the convention to work its will?
Yes.
Senator Warren.
But a convention working its will means that people have the delegates that are pledged to them, and they keep those delegates until
the leading
you come
person?
To the convention.
No?
All
okay.
of the people.
All righty. Vice President Biden?
Play by the rules.
Yes or no? Leading person with the delegates, should they be the nominee or not?
No. Let the process work its way out.
Mayor Buttigieg?
Not necessarily. Not to listen
Senator
to
Senator Klobuchar?
Let the process work.
Senator Sanders?
Well, the process includes 500 superdelegates on the second ballot. So I think
all
that
right.
the will of the people should
okay.
prevail. Yes.
First thank class, you, guys.
Most votes should become the nominee.
Five no's and a yes.
Five no's and a yes. So we heard from Bernie Sanders talking last month that, yes, the person who has the most delegates going into the convention should get the nomination. The other five said, let the process play out. And we'll talk a little bit about the process right now. So his opponents afterwards, the day after and that night, they would say something like, well, Bernie Sanders agreed to these rules for the convention, and he should abide by the rules. And the rules say that if there's no clear majority on the first vote, which are pledged delegates, and presumably you can't change your mind for the pledged delegates, then it goes to a second round. And in that second round, anybody can vote for anybody, and the superdelegates now get to vote. So first of all, what are superdelegates?
So superdelegates are a mixture of like elected official, party leaders, ex-vice presidents, but a majority of them are Democratic National Committee elected officials. So each state has so many DNC members, and it starts at the very local level. After the presidential election, the entire Democratic Party restructures, and we have precinct committee people who vote for state committee people who then go to their states, and they vote for DNC members. So they're basically party insiders who have been elected to represent us at the national level. And that's a majority of the superdelegates or DNC members.
And in this conversation, it's going to sound like we're ganging up on superdelegates because I have one guest who we're going to find out opposes the idea of superdelegates at the convention. I tried to invite a superdelegate to come on and defend them. This person wasn't available. And so let me say when I talked to them on the phone, this person said, well, shouldn't Kathy Castor have a vote during the second round as a superdelegate? Shouldn't Jimmy Carter have a vote as a superdelegate during the second round if there's a brokered convention? And shouldn't I, as a superdelegate, not me, Sean Canaan, the person I spoke to, I'm not going to name this person because they couldn't come on. So,
sure.
Shouldn't I, who've worked in the party for years and years and years, tried to get and gotten people elected, gotten whoever, Obama elect helped to get Barack Obama elected, shouldn't I have a say in the second round about who the nominee is? Shouldn't they?
I think that if they want to say, and this is important, that they should run to be a pledged delegate just like the rest of us. And I think the problem with the Democratic Party is that there's a lot of gatekeeping for power at the top, and that's where it disconnects from what the people want. And that's why we have a lot of problems when we run our nominees necessarily getting votes, is because to say that some people have more of a voice and their voice should be louder and they should be a big D instead of a little D convolutes the process. And it comes back to being reflective. If you have a bunch of people who work inside the party and have vested interests, and a lot of times what I found are people who work inside the party, their goal inside the party is really to guard and consolidate their power and the profits that they make from working inside the party more so than to elect Democrats or even elect Democrats that are popular. So I think we have to really look at the party structure and ask, who are the people who hold the power in the party and what's their agenda? Now, I will say that I think I know who you're talking about, and I'm not going to name any names, but in Florida, the same superdelegates who are saying they should have a voice are also voting to keep a weighted vote, which is something we have in Florida, which is very controversial. And last time our superdelegates almost didn't get sat at the convention because we have this outdated power structure within the Florida Democratic Party that gives more power to 7 big counties than the entire state of Florida. So if all the people in the 7 big counties decide they want to vote, they overrule the rest of our state. And this superdelegate is in favor of keeping that power consolidation. And that's what concerns me, is that once you start working inside the party, you become so insulated, you get disconnected from everyday voters and what direction we should be pushing our party in.
This weighted vote, mm-hmm. is that based on population? Or does it?
It's based on registered Democrats within cities. So the largest cities like South Florida, Hillsborough County, that's one of the 7 biggest counties. And essentially they have 2 people that divide those votes. So Hillsborough County has 66 votes. So every time we go to a state convention to vote on changing our bylaws or changing anything within our party, Hillsborough County holds 66 votes as opposed to 1, and only 2 people can decide those votes. So really it comes down to 14 people in the entire Democratic Party that hold all of the power and makes all the decisions about changing the rules in our parties, opening it up, our bylaws. Everything comes down to these 14 people. And they're the same people who would have to vote to break up that power, and they never do, even though we've been ordered by the national convention or the national party to break that up, or we might not get sat at the convention.
Well, let's talk about the controversy. We'll talk more about the last convention in just a second.
Yes.
I just want to remind people that you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. We're also streaming live on Facebook Live at facebook.com/WMNF News. It's 12:18 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan, and my guest is Jessica Vaughn. She is the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida, founder of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay.
It's a mouthful.
It is, but I finally got it out. So thank you for joining us. And you were at the 2016
yes.
convention,
mm-hmm.
and around this time, March or so of 4 years ago, there was also a talk about superdelegates because it looked like it might, you know, the race between Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders and Hillary Clinton looked like it was going to be very close, and it looked like even if Bernie Sanders were to get the most pledged delegates, that there were so many superdelegates mm-hmm. at the convention that they would be able to put Hillary Clinton into the nomination. And so we had, you know, this is a conversation that everyone had 4 years ago. And so the Democratic Party did do something between 2016 and now with superdelegates. Mm-hmm. What has it done?
So there was a reform committee at the urging of Bernie Sanders surrogates, and they collated with the leaders of the Democratic Party, and they had several different ideas for dealing with superdelegates. But essentially what they came to is what we've already talked about, that as opposed to superdelegates being able to vote on the first round, if we get to a point where there is a brokered convention and no one wins with 50% plus 1 vote, then on the second round is where the superdelegates will come into play. Although I have heard, since Bernie has become more of the front runner, talk about then trying to change those rules again. I think as we get closer to the chance of Bernie walking in there with enough votes to not have a contested convention, now there's some talk of changing that before the convention.
This isn't something I've heard, so you're just saying this, and you have, you know, obviously have more of an inside scoop.
Yes,
than
there have
most
been articles that I can.
Okay, so you're talking about if he would have won on the first poll mm-hmm. because he had not just a plurality, but a majority of pledged delegates.
Correct.
Of people actually going to the polls, still having a brokered convention, because that would be, I think that would be a shocker if that happened.
I think it's going to be a shocker no matter how things go down at this point, because we are definitely at a time where we have, you know, a divided party, and that's reflective in everything that we do. So I feel like, you know, it's going to be contentious regardless.
Let's, what happens on the first ballot is if you have some people who have dropped out already, like Pete Buttigieg has a certain number, it's a very small number right now, of pledged delegates.
I think.
It's very small compared to how many you need, which is 1991 or half of 1991. I can't remember. But do those people have to vote for Pete Buttigieg on the first ballot?
So that's confusing. And I looked it up, and it really seems to depend per state, because every state has different rules. And that's what also makes it, you know, confusing when you're trying to do this. Some states, it sounds like on the first, like Nevada, where he picked up some delegates, they will be pledged to vote for him because he suspended his account and didn't drop out specifically. They will be pledged to vote for him on the first round. However, other states, he can release his delegates to either suggest that they vote for whoever he endorses or let them vote their conscience. So it really depends on the state. And in general, there's no law that pledged delegates have to vote for who they're pledged to. I mean, there's no legal ramifications. So really, I mean, it could be completely chaos and people could vote any way that they want. But per the bylaws, it depends on the state.
And I think that's what Bernie Sanders ended up doing in 2016, is he released his delegates to vote on the first round for Hillary Clinton, and that's what happened in most cases.
Yeah, he released, and there were some, you know, I was part of the Florida delegation. I think there were two or three that then ended up voting for Hillary out of all of the delegates.
But there were some states that Sanders won, and then I remember the announcement coming, the great state of so-and-so gives its 23 delegates to Hillary Clinton. And
correct.
And then you see, you know, in the video footage, you see that the
little
vote
sign.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Someone had held up a little sign and said that the state had been won for Bernie. Yeah.
All right, well, our guest is the founder of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay, Jessica Vaughn. This half hour, we're talking about superdelegates and the convention and the possibility of a brokered convention. And my name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to Midpoint Monday. It's 12:23 in the afternoon. Please stay tuned, because in the second half of the show, it's going to be a great show. We hope that you agree. We're going to talk about Cuba, and Jessica's preferred candidate said something about Cuba about a week ago, and we're going to break down how that is seen. And you've heard from the mainstream media about how that's seen, and we're going to talk to a Cuba expert about what Bernie Sanders said about education under Fidel Castro. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. Since you're a supporter of Bernie Sanders, I want to get to, probably this hour, we'll get to a couple of things from Chris Matthews. I'm not trying to beat up on this man, but he's made a couple of, kind of raised some eyebrows in the last month or so of what he said. So here is Chris Matthews, the night of the Nevada convention, when it looked like Bernie Sanders had won his third, or at least, you know, tied or won his third of three contests, and it looks like he was going to be for sure the front runner for the time being, at least. And you can tell that Chris Matthews was a little bit upset about that, and so here is what he said.
First and foremost, Chris Matthews, I know you as a romantic about American politics and the American political experience. I happen to know Joy Reid is with you. Ditto. She is a romantic about the American political experience. I am guessing you are both by now hardcore realists, that we're looking at a category that says reallocated preference. The first category is what most people define as voting. What is going on here, and is this any way to pick a nominee?
Well, I don't think so, but it is the way we're picking this one, and it looks like Bernie Sanders is hard to beat right now. I'm with Carville all the way in terms of the dangers of what lurks what lies ahead in November. I'm very much aware of them. They're sitting on so much Oppo research on Bernie, what he said in the past about world affairs, how far left he is. I'm not sure how far left he is, but they're going to make the most of that in terms of world politics. They're going to kill him. But I think it's a little late to stop him, and I think that's the problem. By the way, if you look at the pattern, it's dynamic. Bernie won the popular vote in Iowa. He won it again in New Hampshire. It looks like he's going to win it here when they finally get a vote. Bernie's been winning consistently, and I think it's mathematically understandable. Every time we poll, every time Steve and everybody polls, two-thirds of the Democratic vote, two-thirds of people who call themselves Democrats are either liberal or very liberal. All Bernie ever had to do, and he's done it beautifully, is get a majority of that, and he's up to the mid-30s. If you get half of 67, you're into the mid-30s, and that's where he's gotten a little better. Biden, his only prayer was to consolidate the third of the vote that's moderate and conservative. And he got nowhere near clearing that field. Nowhere near. That's split up four ways now. And so with new people coming in, Deval Patrick came in, he didn't make it. Bloomberg is in. He's probably going to survive a bit longer because of his money. But that field wasn't cleared. The only way Biden could win in that one-third of the vote that's either moderate or conservative is to sweep it. He got nowhere near. Bernie, on the other hand, did his job. He got more than a majority of that 67%. That is the name of the game. It is pretty much over unless that changes. I was reading last night, Brian, I know you're a history guy too. I'm reading last night about the fall of France in the summer of 1940, and the general, Renault, calls up Churchill and says, "It's over." And Churchill said, "How can it be? You got the greatest army in Europe. How can it be over?" He said, "It's over." So I had that suppressed feeling. I can't be as wild as Carville, but he is damn smart, and I think he's damn right on this one.
All right, well, that is Chris Matthews talking the night of the Nevada caucuses when Bernie Sanders was looking like his third straight victory. And he later apologized. Chris Matthews later apologized right before the debate, I think it was, when he compared Sanders winning Nevada to the Nazis taking France. But there's also some other things in there. I included a bit of Brian Williams at the beginning. He seemed to me to be contrasting romantic American democracy with the about something he called reallocated preference. And what he's referring to there is in the Nevada caucuses, you vote for your first preference. Mm-hmm. So we now see Bernie Sanders had something like 30% or whatever, and Buttigieg or whoever was second Biden had 10% or however it was.
Right.
And then the ones who didn't make it past a certain threshold, those people got to vote for their second favorite candidate. What that did is that increased Bernie Sanders' lead. Mm-hmm. And so that's called reallocated preference in this thing. You can also think of it, it's almost an analogy to like instant runoff voting or to ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice, yeah.
And the way that Brian Williams just reacted to that, like it was this thing that was contrary to American democracy, just kind of like I included that in there because that kind of blew my mind.
It's interesting, and I think it again comes down to kind of like the gatekeeping of power, because as we see when we talk about voter rights, people are more and more interested in ranked choice voting and more interested in being able to express their preferences at different levels. And I think that threatens, you know, being able to make blanket statements about what's popular and what's not popular. So I think that what's also been interesting is that people who have a certain preference have changed their narrative depending on whether it fits with what they want or not. You know, if the candidate they want is winning by the popular vote, they say that we should be reflective of the popular vote. And then in the next race, if their candidate is winning by, you know, the delegates, they say we should be reflective of the delegates. So I think everybody's narrative on what is the most fair thing or how we should be giving our nomination or winning elections changes also depending on what their bias is.
So back to the brokered convention.
Yes.
Let's say that Bernie Sanders goes in and he has something like 45% of the vote on the first round, clear front runner, maybe the next person has 30%. And yet in the second round, Sanders loses to whoever it is. Let's call it Biden or Bloomberg or Hillary Clinton or whoever ends up being the person. And well, maybe we can even get to why I even said Hillary Clinton just there. Whoever it is on the second round, what would the convention floor look like? And what would all the people who voted How would they take it?
It's hard to say because even at the last convention, it was so contested. And as a Bernie delegate, I think what people who were watching didn't realize is how much suppression there was about that. There were times where lights were turned down on whole delegations because people didn't want to see homemade signs made. There were noise machines put in certain delegations so you couldn't hear the chanting. On the floor of the Florida delegation, at one point, we Bernie supporters were chanting "No more war," and Hillary Clinton delegates were chanting "more war" and trying to hit us with sticks, and instead they threw the flag in front of us and started chanting USA. There were protests all over. There were, you know, I got spat on, I got yelled at, I got pushed at. So just seeing that in an election cycle where there was a more of a clear majority to see a contested convention, one of the reasons I'm not going this time is because I kind of have post-traumatic stress syndrome from the last. I can't even imagine what that will look like. There will be so much angst and anger and chaos. If we want to talk about unifying the party, that's the complete opposite of what will happen to our party, and it will spell disaster for the 2020 election against Donald Trump. There's no way around it.
And I named some names, and you might or might not have insight about this, but of those names, who do you think that if the second place finisher is Joe Biden, of course, it seems like the party would put their votes behind him, the party establishment I'm referring to. What about Bloomberg? And what about if on the second round it becomes Hillary Clinton? What do you know about those, either of those two scenarios?
I haven't thought about it becoming Hillary Clinton. I didn't know if it's possible to nominate somebody who hasn't been in the race. So I can't really speak to that. I think that the establishment will do whatever it takes to stop Bernie Sanders. And I hate to say that. It sounds like a conspiracy theory, and I'm not prone to do conspiracy theories, but I see it in my social media. I see it when I talk to voters. There's such a fear of, you know, him being a radical or extreme. I think that they will collate against whoever isn't Bernie Sanders at the end of the day, whatever that looks like, honestly.
Even if it's Michael Bloomberg of nearly... in the near history, a Republican governor, mayor.
I think so. If it means that, you know, it's somebody who's not going to push for Medicare for all or, you know, all of the things that are considered so radical, I think that they will absolutely line up. I've already seen party leaders who aren't supposed to necessarily have a clear preference. It's okay for party leaders to endorse and to say, this is who I want. But I've seen our superdelegates who we've talked about, and we have 11 here in Florida, spread conspiracy theories. There's been articles about Bernie Sanders collecting dark money and, you know, being anti-Semitic. And these are the people who are supposed to be our leaders who have nonstop attacked our front runner at this point and have already lined up behind the centrist candidate, you know, openly. And we're not even a quarter of the way into the primary season. So there's no doubt in my mind that as it gets deeper, since they've already made their preferences so clear, and these were the same people who said that Andrew Gillum took dark money in the election. You know, our superdelegates who were supposed to be supporting our front runner, you know, they are so establishment based and so afraid of progressive ideas and what that means to their power consolidation that they'll do whatever it takes to hold on to that power. That's really what I believe. And it's sad, and I hate to say that, but that's what I've witnessed between working in the party for the last 4 years.
And we're going to move on to the Cuba section of the show in just a second, but I want to quickly ask you, what do you think might happen tomorrow? What do you think might happen in California? What might happen in Texas?
I mean, I believe that Bernie Sanders is going to wow us. He's going to do really well in Texas. I mean, he's kind of right on the line with Biden. With Buttigieg dropping out, that's going to cause, you know, some changes in the polling, and not to say polling is great, but I think overwhelmingly he's going to take California. I think he's going to take Texas. I think he's going to take 9 out of the 15 territories and walk in there with a huge delegate lead. But again, with Buttigieg dropping out last night, you know, kind of last minute, that's going to change things. So we'll have to see where that goes.
Well, our guest is Jessica Vaughn. She's the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay founder, and she's going to be back in the second half of the program. But right now we're going to take a very short music break. So please stay tuned. We're going to bring in our next guest, and we'll talk about Cuba and what Bernie Sanders said about the education system there. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. We'll be right back.
De Andocero voy para Macané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarí. De Andocero voy para Macané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarí.
Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. It's 12:36 in the afternoon. And for the rest of this hour, we're going to talk about Cuba. And joining us in the studio is Al Fox. He's a Cuba expert and head of the Alliance for Responsible Cuba Policy Foundation. Welcome back to WMNF, Al.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you coming in. So we're going to play a soundbite from Bernie Sanders in just a few minutes. But I first want to get a little bit of background on you and your organization, the Cuba Alliance.
Well, my career was in Washington, D.C. for 41 years, and my mother was born in Cuba, but left Cuba when she was 1 year old.
Sorry to interrupt. Under what leader was that?
Oh, it was in 1916. I don't know who was the president of Cuba.
Yeah, was that under Fidel? Or
No. Okay. She lived to be 95 and passed away. But as a result of that, I just one day had the idea I wanted to visit the country that my mother was born in. And I was told I couldn't go. Fidel Castro and human rights, and it's fine. But anyway, the only way to go to Cuba, you had to have a license, and so I founded this organization. I've now been to Cuba over 120 times in 20 years. I had 9 meetings with Fidel Castro. I was one of the people that played a principal role in getting little boy Elian Gonzalez to go back to Cuba where he belonged with his family. So many in the Cuban-American community have a great affection for me, and many in the Cuban-American despise me very, very much. But it is what it is. But the work of the Alliance is not about helping the people of Cuba. It's about helping the people of the United States. All of us could go right now to North Korea and to Iran, because that's your right as an American. But you can't go to Cuba because of human rights violations and this and that and all these other propaganda-type stories. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Cuba is a very controlled society. There is no question about that. They do not have a lot of the freedoms that we have. But at the same time, and this is what gets me in trouble, the masses in Cuba live better today than they ever did under Florencio Batista and under many of the other dictators that they had there. Healthcare, education is without question one of the best in the Western Hemisphere, and I've seen it firsthand repeatedly. And unfortunately, Cuba has no military, and they're not any power. And they were a surrogate state for 30 years of the Soviet Union. There's no question about that. From 61 to 91, Cuba was nothing more than a satellite state of the Soviet Union. But why? Because in 59 and 60, we squeezed the Cuban government. And we told them, you must do this and you must do that. And they said, no, we're going to do things differently now. And they wanted to be our friend then, and they wanted to be our friend now. But the Cuban government was faced with a decision. The most powerful country in the world, the United States, was squeezing them. And the second most powerful country in the world at that point in time was the Soviet Union. And they were hugging, playing kissy face with them, and we can help you here and we can help you there. And why? Putin is going to go to Cuba in 2 months. Why is he going to come halfway around the world to a country to do what? He misses baseball or salsa dancing or black beans? No, it's 90 miles from you and me. The very reason they went there in the first place. Okay, and so it is insane, in my opinion, immoral and inhuman how we squeeze that small, sovereign, independent country.
So here are a couple of things I'm hearing. I'm hearing that you met with Fidel Castro, and I'm hearing you defend some of the things that happened under Fidel Castro. Are you a socialist? Are you a commie?
Well, you can say a lot of things about me, but communism is not one of them. I'm a capitalist through and through. I believe in capitalism. I think it's a great economic system. But the Achilles heel of capitalism is greed. And that is the rub. But yes, I had several meetings, nine meetings with Fidel Castro over the years, and they were fascinating and they were interesting. And if I could take the time to tell a little story, I asked him one day, I said, Mr. President, in my country, there's a school of thought that says you like the embargo, you like the blockade, it keeps you in power, it gives you a reason to tell the Cuban people, we don't have this and we don't have that because of the blockade. And he looked at me and he said, well, of course I've heard that argument. He said, but Albert, I thought you were smarter than that. I don't recall dumb in front of 15 people as a congressman from Tennessee, John Tanner. And he said, do you realize what you have said? He said, you have said that Fidel Castro likes the embargo, the blockade, as they call it. And that's why the United States keeps it in place, because they like to do what Fidel Castro likes. Okay, I said, Mr. President, there's another school of thought in my country that goes like this, that when the blockade, the embargo is removed, and a million Americans travel freely here and talk about private property and entrepreneurship, that this government can't last 12 months. And he looked at me very dramatically and he said, well, then I don't understand what the problem is. You lift it. I'll take my chances. Now, you can spin that any way you want to spin it, but that was there. We're there. I took three-star Marine General Michael DeLong for the Central Command here. He spent 3.5 hours with Fidel Castro. And it was, they were fascinating experiences. And so I have concluded that I don't care who is the president of Cuba. It could be Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, I don't care. But I do care how my great country treats other foreign countries. And we cannot stick our nose in every country in the world. And if they don't do what we want them to do, we embargo them. We squeeze them economically. And another argument's made now that Cuba's propping up the government in Venezuela. I mean, that defies belief that a poor third world country props up a first world country. That's never happened since Adam and Eve. Yes, they're allies. Yes, they work closely together. But the American government, the American people, we never cared about the poor people in Venezuela until a new government of Venezuela came in and they would not do what we told them to do. All of a sudden, we're worrying about the poor people in Venezuela and they don't have this and they don't have that. That is their problem. That is not our problem in America.
Our guest is Al Fox, and he's the head of the Alliance for Responsible Cuba Policy Foundation. We also have in the studio Jessica Vaughn, who is with the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay, and she's a supporter of Bernie Sanders. And we're going to play a clip right now that got this conversation started, and it's a clip of Bernie Sanders being interviewed by Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes. It aired 8 days ago. And, oh boy, it set off such a firestorm. So let's hear this super controversial thing that Bernie Sanders said.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing? Even though Fidel Castro did it.
There's a lot of dissidents imprisoned in Cuba.
That's right, and we condemn that. Unlike Donald Trump, let's be clear, I do not think that Kim Jong-un is a good friend. I don't trade love letters with a murdering dictator. Vladimir Putin, not a great friend of mine.
So Bernie Sanders there saying that there was a lot of repression in Cuba, but they happen to have a good education system under Castro. And you would think from the news reaction last week that he said that the devil is beautiful or something. I don't even know how, in my opinion, ridiculous all the conversation was. What did Bernie Sanders say there, and was it off the rails?
Well, he didn't say anything that was off the rails. That's a fact. But unfortunately, we have created this boogeyman. I mean, we still talk about Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro has been dead for 5 years. He was out of power 5 years before that. And we were all indoctrinated that until Fidel is gone, nothing is going to change in that relationship. He's been gone for 10 years, and we moved the goalposts. And when the embargo was initially in place, totally in 1961, Secretary of State Dean Rusk at the time, speaking at the Organization of American States, said, we don't have any interest in the internal workings in Cuba. We're imposing this embargo because we want Cuba to stop its military relationship with the Soviet Union and to stop trying to spread revolution in the Western Hemisphere. That was stopped a long time ago, but we keep moving the goalposts. But this, you've heard a lot of our politicians in the state of Florida. You had the governor of this state talk about the insanity of Senator Sanders' words, and that he says then all Floridians are never going to forget that. Well, 75 to 80% of Floridians support engagement with the Cuban government as it is, not how we want it to be. Almost 60% of Cuban Americans in Broward, Miami, Dade County were more than happy with the provisions that Barack Obama, President Obama, started. Everybody loved it. Everybody was happy. There was not a problem, except with about 1,000 people in Miami, about 100 people in Tampa, and about 250 people in Union City, New Jersey. That's it. They set the policy. And they've got this great boogeyman, Fidel Castro, you know. And it's, I think, as I say, it's immoral. I was in Cuba when Fidel Castro passed, November 2015. Around 4 or 5 o'clock, word came out. And by 7 o'clock that night, you had over a million people in the streets of Revolutionary Square. Now, as I said, Cuba is a controlled society, but you can't make a million people show out in the street. And today, right now, this moment, in his gravesite in Santiago de Cuba, there's a line of people just to walk by to touch his... he was cremated. He read a letter to his brother read a letter to people saying that he's now in the history. He does not one building, one road named after him, not a school named after Fidel Castro. He put that in writing to the people. When you say that he was revered in Cuba, I mean, you can just imagine what that's like, because we've been propagandized that everybody on the island of Cuba can't wait to leave. Well, if that in fact was true, they had the easiest ticket to get out of there. They only got to come 90 miles. Up until recently, they came here, they got $300 a month, food stamps, health care benefits, aid to education, and small business loan. So this nonsense about that, how they come in shark-infested waters and 90 miles and they risk their lives to come here, they had a lot to come here for free. Well, that's socialism, if you want to say that. Really. But you tell the people of Haiti, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Colombia, Honduras, Mexico, that the same immigration policy that a Cuban got, you would have tomorrow. Let me tell you something. You could walk the 600 miles between here and Haiti. There'd be so many inner tubes and rafters and cardboard boxes. But they got to come 600 miles, knowing when they touch American soil and get caught, they're immediately deported. Or a Cuban coming 90 miles, knowing that they touch our soil, they get to stay. Now, what did President Trump do in the last few months? What was happening was is that people were complaining to Marco Rubio, saying, fellow colleagues, members of the Congress, were complaining to Marco Rubio, saying, you've asked me to support all these policies to Cuba blindly, and I do. And so he gives special asylum to a Cuban that comes here. But now people are telling me that after have this special asylum, they go back to Cuba on vacation. They go back to Cuba to celebrate their grandmother's 85th birthday. How can that be? Well, so then the Rubio themselves, so then they've clamped down. So right now, there's like 20,000 Cubans in Mexico that were making their way up to come to our border. Well, now we're not letting them cross the border. Now if you had a mother or a sister or aunt or an uncle in Cuba and you want them to come visit you in the United States will not give them a visa to come. And the idea is to make the poor in Cuba suffer so badly that they'll take to the streets and overthrow the government. If that hasn't happened in 61 years, if that didn't happen when the Soviet Union went belly up for about 5-6 years, people, I'm talking about no toilet paper, no toothpaste from like 91 and 96. If they didn't take to the streets then, they're not ever going to take to the streets.
They call that the special period, I think.
The special period, yeah.
813-239-9663. If you'd like to join this conversation, our guest is Al Fox, the Alliance for Responsible Cuba Policy Foundation. It's 12:49 in the afternoon. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. You may also be watching on Facebook Live, facebook.com/WMNF News. And my guest also is Jessica Vaughn, the founder of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay. We'll try to get you into the conversation as well. I'm enthralled with what Al's telling us right now. One of the things that you mentioned is that there are no streets named after Fidel. I should say there are quite a number of billboards with Fidel's face on them and revolutionary slogans, though. So it's not like
Yeah, that's true. No, but those were there before. But when you say quite a number of billboards, I don't think there's 10 billboards in the whole country.
Compared to the U.S., definitely not quite a number.
Like I said, and I've been everywhere there. And Caller coming in.
Oh, no, that's okay. So, what about the education system? Bernie Sanders said that under Fidel, the education system in Cuba was top-notch. You mentioned it briefly at the beginning, but what can you tell us about education in Cuba?
Well, education, it's the most literate society in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, that's just a fact. That's not Al Fox talking. There's the International Red Cross, Amnesty International. I mean, these are documented facts. And firsthand, I mean, you go to Cuba and you go to a restaurant, you go to a lounge, you get in a cab, and just start talking to the cab driver. About 4 years, well, it was Barack Obama's last election, and I was up in the mountain range, about 4 hours out of Havana, horseback riding. And, I mean, this is about as rural as you can get, and came back in, and fellow at the barn there was unsaddling the horse, and he said, "You're an American, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "May I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." And he said, "Who's going to win the presidency, Barack Obama or Mitt Romney?" Here's a guy in the boonies, yet we're told that they're out of touch. You ask any Cuban, any high school student, any doorman, any waiter, you know, about what's happening in the United States now, the Supreme Court nominations before the United States Senate. And you can carry on a conversation with them. Ask any high school student in America who the president of Cuba is, who's the president of the National Assembly is, and they don't have a clue. What's their system, how these people are elected, you know. And, of course, when I talk this way, I say, well, this guy must be a communist. And I've been called that a lot. I was investigated for 9 years by the IRS and the FBI. Why? Because handful of people here in Tampa call the FBI and say, this guy Fox, he's involved in a drug deal with Fidel Castro. I had all my bank records seized. I was arrested here 4 years ago by a Cuban-American police officer. And he was speeding, and then when he realized it was me, he arrested me for DUI. Now, I notified back. I spent 12 hours in two different jails. Two different, that's never happened. And I was stone sober. My blood alcohol content was 0.00. But the city dug in. I sued the city. I won $75,000 from the city. That police officer was fired, and he was just a dirty cop. It's something that most American politicians just don't want to hear the crazies come at them. I think the local radio program here last week, which prompted my mind, they had some Democratic expert. And this is what he said. He said, well, it's only been about the last 10, 15 years where Cuban Americans in Miami have started to vote Democratic. I don't know where that guy has been, but he never heard of somebody named former Senator George Smathers or Lawton Childs or Bob Graham or Bill Nelson. All of them pandered to this handful of extremists in Miami. Gloria Estefan sings songs about freedom and democracy, but she doesn't tell you who her father was. Her father was chief of security for Fulgencio Batista. Her father was on the plane when Batista deserted Cuba New Year's Eve 1959. Her father, from 1953 to 1955, from 1953 to 1958, in that five-year period, in a country of 4 million people, the Batista dictatorship executed 20,000 Cuban citizens. I mean, up against the wall, bang, you're dead. In the last 20 years, there have been 5 executions in Cuba. Yet these people in the program talk about the daily, the weekly executions that take place in Cuba. Well, I don't know where they're taking place, okay? But these are documented facts, but a lot of our political leaders do not want to get involved into the controversy. So it's best to look the other way, you know? And this is, you know, we have a president. We have a president that says up is down and down is up and black is white and white. And everybody knows he's just lying through his teeth. But to challenge him creates more problems for you. So they just look the other way.
Our guest is Al Fox. He's the head of the Alliance for Responsible Cuba Policy Foundation, and you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. And my name is Sean Canaan, and we're on WMNF's Midpoint right now, 12:55 in the afternoon. We have a few minutes left, and I'm going to play this clip from Barack Obama speaking a few days ago, because when Bernie Sanders made this statement that Cuba under Castro had good education, members, you mentioned the governor of Florida, the Republican governor of Florida, criticizing that, but even members of Jessica's party, the Democratic Party, really spoke out and hammered Sanders on this. Well, here is what Barack Obama said about this several years ago.
And I said this to President Castro in Cuba. I said, look, you've made great progress in educating young people. Every child in Cuba gets a basic education. That's a huge improvement from where it was. Medical care. You know, the life expectancy of Cubans is equivalent to the United States, despite it being a very poor country, because they have access to health care. That's a huge achievement. They should be congratulated. But you drive around Havana and this economy is not working. It looks like it did in the 1950s. And so you have to be practical in asking yourself, how can you achieve the goals of equality and inclusion?
So, Jessica, that was President Barack Obama a few years ago talking about the bad things in Cuba, but also talking about how the education system was good. How did you feel when you heard essentially your candidate, Bernie Sanders, being attacked for saying almost the same thing last week?
I was so unbelievably disappointed, and I definitely made sure that I was publicly open about that, especially since some of the candidates had elicited Bernie Sanders support when they were running. Some of the people like Andrew Gillum, who I supported, came out and attacked Bernie on that. And I was unbelievably disappointed to see our Democratic Party not supporting our front runner and giving him the benefit of the doubt and being honest to the fact that there are other countries where we may not agree with their leadership who have invested in their people and done good things. And what we should be taking away from that is the investment in education and healthcare and how we should be supporting that for our own people. So just seeing that was another indication to me that based on your bias or what you're trying to control or where your power lies, you're willing to say or do anything to justify what you believe in, honestly.
And Al, it's not just education. You've complimented the great medical conditions in Cuba. What can you tell us about healthcare and also the quality of doctors that can go to other places and do medical work?
And to Jessica's point, if I could just add one thing, Sean, before that, and that is that I found that what Congresswoman Donna Shalala mentioned was absolutely disgusting. She knows better. I was a big fan of Donna Shalala when she was in Washington, D.C., but she has just completely pandered and whores herself to these extremists down there now. And for her to make a statement that she found Senator Sanders' statement disgusting because of the murders that take place there, okay, the political prisoners that are still there since the revolution, that's just factually not true, okay? But in Miami, you can say those things because you don't want to deal with the other side. On the medical side, in 2004, when the Ebola crisis came out, the first people there in those Western African countries were Cuban doctors. And here's one of the crazy ironies. The United States Corps of Engineers built a field hospital so Cuban doctors could examine all these people there. So you had the Corps of Engineers of the United States working together with Cuban doctors, but they couldn't say it. When the earthquake hit Haiti in 2012 and there was a massive fear of cholera spreading like crazy, it was Cuban doctors that were sent there initially, transported there by the Corps of Engineers, but they can't talk about that. And so for American propaganda to say that these Cuban doctors all around the world, thousands upon thousands, okay, is a slave trade. And their families are held hostage in Cuba, and that's why they got to do it. I mean, that is just not true. You have the head of the emergency room in Brandon Memorial Hospital here in Brandon, who was educated in Cuba to get his medical degree free of charge. There's a school that was started there. Ironically, Congressman Claiborne played a part in that in the meeting that he had with Fidel Castro in 2000. So in 2000, Fidel created a school free from anybody in the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint today, Jessica and Al. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Al Fox is a Cuba expert and head of the Alliance for Responsible Cuba Policy Foundation, and Jessica Vaughn is founder of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Tampa Bay and a supporter of Bernie Sanders. And I'm sorry I didn't get to any phone calls, but if you would like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts, call me at 813-238-8001, extension 114. I'll play your message next show. If you missed any of the show, you can listen to it on our website, wmnf.org/news. You can also watch it on Facebook at WMNF News, and you can share it there as well. Join us at Facebook, YouTube, or Twitter at WMNF News. Thanks to Blaney Whalen, Barbara Fling, Alvaro Montes.